Welcome to Sex with Simmery. Frank, occasionally explicit edutainment on the most important topic of all. Sex with Simmery is not intended for children and is not safe for work unless your boss is particularly awesome. See more at sexwithsimmery.com.
Hey, friends and family of Sex with Simmery. We are so grateful to have your listenership. We have the coolest fans in the world. It's pretty much the best. And we hope that the love is mutual. If you are interested in supporting the Sex with Simmery media, either the website, the podcast, head on over to patreon.com/sexwithsimmery and become a supporter. For as little as $1 a month, you can be a regular supporter and continue to bring independent media that provides the kind of information that you want to have out in the world. Over here at Sex with Simmery, we have been doing this stuff for years. As you've noticed, we've got over 200 episodes. The Sex with Simmery website has been up since 2008. We've been giving you the goods for absolutely no cost, and we will continue to do so as long as we can. So thank you so much for your listenership, and we do hope that you will check it out. Patreon.com/sexwithsimmery. Hello, and welcome to Sex with Simmery. This is Dr. Simmery, and I am, as you can expect, very fucking excited to introduce you to today's guest. It has been a long time since we had anyone on the show with this particular background and expertise. So not only are you going to find the topic interesting, but I am personally interested to see how things have changed since we last had a conversation with someone with this background. So I'm very excited to introduce to you Brian Gibney. How are you doing, Brian?
Hey, Dr. Simmery, how are you doing?
I'm fantastic. It is cold as balls here.
Yes, it is.
Very real. that is kind of the primary problem I have right now. It is difficult to get naked because it's cold. And that is troublesome. But yeah, I'm excited to have you on because you are an IPSA-trained intern surrogate partner. And we've had surrogates on this program before, but it's been a while. So I'm very interested to hear not only about your story, but how things have changed since the last time we talked about this. So can you just tell folks who may not be familiar with that what it is that you do?
Sure thing. So IPSA, which stands for the International Professional Surrogates Association, is an organization that trains and coordinates surrogate partners. Surrogate partners do surrogate partner therapy, and they work with licensed therapists to help clients, to help them overcome obstacles that they might have to physical and emotional intimacy. And that's kind of a mouthful, but the long and the short of it is, say a therapist has a client that they're working with that they find talk therapy just is not going to be able to help them overcome their problem. They call us in and they say, hey, my client needs to overcome erectile dysfunction issues, has severe social anxiety, and has issues dating people. What we do is we use a slow, gentle process in tandem with a talk therapy to help the clients overcome those issues.
The first time that I ever heard about surrogates, I was in grad school and we were discussing the basics of sex therapy. This is very intro mm-hmm. level at this point. And we were talking about various techniques that one would take home to use with a partner, etc. And then as though I had literally been hired to be the segue, I went, but what if you don't have a partner?
Uh-huh.
And then Dr. Staten was like, wait till I show you what's next. And then introduces us to Dr. Susan Kay, who was the first person I ever talked to about surrogacy. And I was like, whoa. And it was like blowing my mind because it was like, okay, so this is real practical. This is, you know, when we talk about education, as teachers, as sex educators, you know, there's like the theory. There's like we can use these mm-hmm. words and we can talk about the concepts. We can talk about these huge constructs and how they fit into systems of oppression, blah, 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 like that sort of thing. But to actually synthesize and apply these things in a practical way so anybody can use them, that's right. Another thing. That's a very different yep. thing. So yep. so surrogates are doing the work that, you know, a therapist can't do.
Mm-hmm. For ethical and practical reasons. You know, therapists can't be trained in everything. And when it comes to sex ed, we have a very different skill set than a talk therapist would have. For ethical reasons, of course, a therapist can't do what we're doing because we're establishing a different kind of intimate relationship. And that is not good for ethical boundaries for the therapist.
So I'm curious, what you think about where your profession lies on like a spectrum of sex work? Would you consider it a form of that?
Ah, the dreaded question that our organization has been looking at a lot lately. No, it is. So the spoiler alert is I'm not actually going to answer that question, but I am going to talk about some interesting philosophy surrounding that. The reason why I'm not going to answer that question is because when you start talking about sex work, it is a very loaded question. We come into that label with very loaded judgment in our society because we have very preconceived notions of what sex work is. But we do work with bodies. We are working with a client on sexual issues. You know, what does an OBGYN do? They do work with bodies, and it is primarily sexually based. It's not as intimate as what we do, but I feel like there is a broad spectrum of what physical work is with the body, and somewhere there in there is surrogate partner therapy. Is it what most people would consider sex work? I don't know. It depends on what their definition of sex work is. That I'm going to leave you guys with that. If you want to sit down and have a beer one night and we can talk about the nuances of that, I would be more than happy to do that.
Because, I mean, that's a question I tend to ask, I mean, most people that are on the show, quite frankly, because, like, who identifies that way, you know, is very much a personal choice, because there are people who do the same job and they answer that differently. And
the truth of the matter is, we might have people in the organization that will answer one way or another way, but we have to make sure that our personal political values don't somehow influence the larger organization as far as how it's perceived professionally.
So what are the qualifications of someone who gets to call themselves a surrogate partner? Like, what sort of training have you gone through and will you be going through going forward?
So as far as training goes, there's an application and interview process that happens even before you really go through the training. Quite a few people get weeded out at that stage because really there isn't the same kind of academic vetting that, say, a therapist would go through, going through years of university training. A lot of it is, you know, are you a decent moral person? Can you communicate well? Do you have a reasonable amount of sex positivity and a decent amount of background already in your life in areas of sexuality and intimacy? Once you get vetted through that application process, there is a 12-day training program in which your existing knowledge is supplemented by lecture and hands-on activities where you pair up with a training partner and you essentially go through what a client would go through in surrogate partner therapy. During the course of that training, not everybody makes it. There are clearly some people that are able to work under those conditions better than others. After that, a trainee would be invited to intern status or not. And as an intern, you would work under the supervision of a more experienced surrogate partner, start taking on clients, and then work towards your full certification, which is the stage that I'm at right now.
What do you think are the characteristics of someone who would be good at this field? And how important is it that you have, like, an innately high sexual drive? Is that remotely related or?
Not at all, no. Okay. I think a healthy view of sexuality, sex positivity is a very good thing because we want to be able to normalize sexuality, body image, just being physical beings to the client. So we can't really shy away from issues about sexuality at all. But having a high libido is not at all an issue. Really, things like empathy and patience are far more important to a surrogate partner. Because this is a process where you might be working with a client that doesn't necessarily know how to express themselves, You have to be very patient in holding their hands along the way to help them learn how to have good communication skills, good body image, and be able to have good, strong yeses and nos. Those skills are way more important than the actual sexuality component, which turns out to be such a small percentage of what the actual work is.
Who are the types of folks who would benefit from having a surrogate help them?
That's a good question. In general, there are clients that have either different types of past trauma, so they're victims of abuse or assault. You might have late-life virgins who, for one reason or another, find themselves not very experienced in sexuality, in dating, any kind of intimacy with another person, and they find that it's just too hard to overcome that obstacle in order to start on their own. People also have various types of dysfunctions. So a male client might have erectile dysfunction or premature ejaculation. Female clients often have, if they have physiological issues, they might be experiencing genital pain like vulvar vestibulitis or vaginismus. You know, there may be one third of women out there experience some kind of pain during during intercourse. So that is actually a much more prevalent problem than you would think. You also might have a client that has severe social anxiety, or even folks with physical disabilities that just have to navigate the world a little bit differently because they're not viewed as sexual objects.
That certainly seems to be some of the representations we've seen in media, because I think probably the most famous representation of a surrogate would be from, oh my God, the name of the movie just fell out of my head.
Sessions?
The Sessions, yeah, which was based on an article.
With Helen Hunt.
Yeah. But it was the client was, like, I believe in an iron lung.
He was in an iron lung, yeah.
So that's probably, I would assume, the most famous depiction in media. Are there any other ones that, like, I'm missing?
That's pretty much it.
That's amazing.
Yeah, two very underrepresented populations all in one movie.
Wow. Yeah. What did you think of either that original article or of the film? Did it seem fair and realistic?
Things in the movie happened very quickly. And that is not typically how things go with surrogate partner therapy, at least not nowadays. I know there are different people that would call themselves surrogate partner therapists. You know, we have a pretty strict code of ethics, and doing the things that were done in that movie is not IPSA approved at this stage.
What are examples of things that aren't approved?
So if I remember correctly, there was sexual contact very early on in their relationship. That's not how we roll nowadays at all. Another thing is there was no therapist to be found, if I remember correctly. And that is, and the triadic model, so working with a therapist, a surrogate partner, and a client is very, very important. We need to have a therapist to bounce ideas off of. We need to be able to glean information from the client, give that back to the therapist, and then have the therapist use that information to further their work with the client. So to work without a therapist is really handicapping the process.
I mean, because you're providing a specific different service. It's supposed to be complementary, and in many of the ways that, I said before, like if you're just seeing a sex therapist and you don't have a partner to work things out with, like there are some limitations to the degree to which you'll be able to get something.
You know, one of the metaphors that I like to use is you can have an engineer that can build a car, that can build an engine. And they might be able to do it on paper, but when something goes wrong with the engine, you take it to a mechanic. You take it to someone who can work with their hands, who can get in there and fix the problem. The engineer designs the car, and the mechanic has to have a basic fundamental understanding of what's going on, but they're not going to have the same level of the depth of understanding that the engineer would. And the engineer certainly can't use their hands in the same way that the mechanic can. So it's a complementary process for sure.
So in terms of getting in there and fixing the problem, I mean, so far we've discussed this as a almost panacea for sexual issues, but like, do we have any stats on like success rates? Has anybody gotten real research into the effectiveness?
So there are a couple of studies out there. There's and I'm blanking on the name. Research group from Israel, and I will probably be able to pull that up later. They have done a study with female clients that I believe are experiencing vaginismus, and they have a very, very high success rate when they're working with a surrogate partner, as opposed to talk therapy alone, which is a significantly lower percentage. More anecdotally, I was at a recent IPSA conference, and one of the surrogate partners said that she was at an ASEC meeting, the American Association Sex Educators, Counselors, and Therapists. Someone came up to her and said, I don't believe that surrogate partner therapy does good work. I do plenty of good work as a talk therapist alone. 60% of my male clients, when they come in talking about erectile dysfunction, leave, and they're able to have sufficient erections for intercourse. You know, what makes you think that you're so good? And she's like, well, 100% of my clients leave having functional erection.
Hmm.
And that really brings an interesting point. So our work is done when the client is ready to be done. And in that case, if a client cannot have a functional erection, then the work isn't done.
Like makes me wonder how much does this cost? Because I can't imagine insurance covers this.
Yeah, not at this point in time. Insurance does not cover it. Our prices are usually comparable to what a normal talk therapist prices rate would be.
Okay, and while we're on this practical piece, what is the legal stance towards surrogacy, and does it vary like place to place?
As far as I know, it doesn't vary in that there really aren't any specific laws against surrogate partner therapy. We're in this very interesting legal gray zone where we're not considered prostitution because clearly we do so many other things other than erotic work. So most states do not have laws at all, even addressing what surrogate partner therapy is. Other than the fact that California recently, the district attorney of California recently said that they will no longer prosecute any type of allegations that are brought against people working in the industry, like it's pretty much a non-issue. And part of that is the fact that we are so well self-regulated. You know, because we have our own strict ethical code and we police our own, there really aren't that many issues. And the other issue is there's just not a whole lot of us out there. So it's not a big political point.
Do you have any sort of concept of how many surrogates are in our operation today?
Right. So there are about 50 IPSA-trained surrogates out there. Most of them are based on the West Coast because California.
Yeah.
but I feel like there are probably a lot more non-IPSA-trained and certified people out there that would say that they're doing surrogate partner therapy, which is... It's a very interesting point to talk about because they don't always work in a triadic model. And I find that that has potential for some real harm.
Like if somebody were to just take on a client without a talk therapist?
Right, right.
What would be the repercussions if somebody tried to do that?
Well, so in surrogate partner therapy, you are entering into a very intimate relationship with the client. You're modeling what healthy relationship should look like. But it's pretty easy to overstep your bounds if you don't have someone looking over your shoulder. You know, as a surrogate partner, I have to have a little therapist in the back of my head all the time saying, is this for the benefit of the client? If for some reason I am less professional and more human, and that voice doesn't go off, I need to have someone watching my back and saying, make sure that you're doing it for the client's good. If I don't do that, then things can go sideways pretty fast.
What might that look like? Like, just for an example, what would be a boundary that would be possible to cross without that sort of like structure?
So I think a pretty easy example would be that one of the things that is clearly stated in our code of ethics, and one of the things that we discuss with clients in the very first meeting together with the therapist, is that this is a process, it's a therapeutic process. We are professionals, but there's also a very clear end to the process. There is no relationship afterwards. Often circuit partners will write in a 1 or 2 year kind of communication hiatus that is at the discretion of the therapist. So there's to be no communication between the surrogate partner and the client for quite some time after the sessions are completed. So if that third party wasn't there, if a surrogate decided that they wanted to have a non-professional relationship with a client, those ethicals, the ethical boundaries could be reached, and a professional relationship could slide into a personal relationship, which is probably not under the most healthy circumstances in that case.
I remember specifically one of the first documentaries that I ever saw around surrogates featured a woman who I believe was working out of San Francisco. Surprise! And I believe her live-in partner, if not spouse, was a former client. And I remember thinking, huh, about how interesting that's got to be. Like, not only for the foundation of their relationship, but her like relationship going forward, given that she continues to do this work. So...
I feel like one of the things that IPSA has done very well over the past few decades is establish a pretty sound code of ethics. Back when surrogate partner therapy was started, it was done through the research of Masters and Johnson. It was back in the late 60s, early 70s. And surrogate partner therapy after those studies really grew during the 70s. But it was also during the 70s. And there were fairly loose rules back then. So I feel like as generations of surrogate partners become much more conscious of their role in the therapeutic process, and we talk more about the nuances of it, I think we are much better about establishing safe and healthy rules.
So how is it for you personally? I mean, you have been at this for how long?
So I was trained in the fall of 2016.
Okay. So have you had a fair number of clients yet? Have you had enough clients to say that you have an impression of what types of folks you're going to be working with?
So I have just gone through the training process. Okay. I have not had a client yet. Most of the reason is because it is fairly new to the East Coast. There are not too many people out here who do it, and consequently there are not too many therapists that are super gung-ho about it. So a lot of it is for me establishing a network with those therapists and introducing myself, letting them know that I can work with their clients and have it be healthy and productive and not a damaging process.
So for all the therapists out there listening, to hit up Ryan. So you've talked to other folks, I assume, about like their experiences though, when you,
right.
So what are some of the things that you were told to look out for on a personal level, like ways to make sure that you're keeping your own boundaries intact?
Right. So, boundary keeping is actually fairly easy through the process that we go through, because there are lots of levels of containers that we use. Many of the exercises are set up specifically as, they serve dual purposes. There's the kind of academic component, but there is also the trust building component. And as a surrogate partner, you have to have kind of two hats that you're wearing. You're wearing this hat as literally a surrogate partner, someone who's walking through the steps of partnership with you. But you're also the teacher. The thing that I've heard a lot of people talk about is that it is hard work. So we really don't take on too many clients all at once. There are very few people that can do this full time, just because, I mean, imagine trying to juggle 40 hours a week of very intense relationships. It's not realistic for most people. You want to be able to be fresh and present with each client to make sure that they get the help that they need. So yeah, burnout is a possibility. I think another thing that many surrogate partners would struggle with is, in general, we like to help people, and we have to constantly struggle against putting the client's needs over our needs. But that in turn actually serves as an opportunity for us to teach clients about personal boundaries and relationship dynamics. So even the challenging parts are actually a really good lesson for a client.
I'm curious, and I know that you don't necessarily have a ton of personal experience to answer this from, but maybe you've heard from other folks. How does attraction to a client affect treatment? Like, does it make it easier, harder?
That's a really good question. I think that's probably one of the most frequent questions I've had. The process is designed to foster intimacy and attraction. You know, I don't have to walk into a therapist's office and meet the client and see someone that's like a 10 and say, "Ooh, I really want to work with that person," because the process itself is going to develop an attraction. So it's physical attraction is almost irrelevant, because you learn to develop an intimate relationship with the partner, and you're able to kind of create a good energy between the two of you if everything's going well.
In terms of the actual experience, so I'm having never had this sort of work myself. I'm curious, like literally, practically, what kind of stuff are you going to end up doing? Like how much of your time is spent fucking, for instance?
Like 0% is actually spent fucking.
Oh.
Sorry.
I'm a little disappointed.
I know it's not as salacious and fun as you thought. So I guess in terms of what you think fucking would be, the reality is by the time a client is ready to do the fucking, they're done with the process. They go off and they get to practice with someone else. A lot of what we do is grouped in about four different stages. And the first stage is just communication work. It's getting comfortable with each other. It's building a good foundation of trust. Doing very, very basic exercises in nurturing touch, for example. One of my favorite exercises during that stage is something that we call "May I Will You," where it basically brings a client through all the different stages of consent, learning their no's, learning their yeses, and being able to be authentic in that communication. After that, we usually go to more sensual work. An example would be a hand caress, something as basic as that, or learning how to normalize and appreciate bodies. I think the most interesting exercise in that is what we call the mirror meditation, where the surrogate partner and the client will disrobe in front of a mirror and talk about their bodies in form, function, and perception. And that brings up some very, very interesting stuff. But still, no fucking. We're not, like, it's not, we haven't even begun to work into the more erotic areas. After we establish a really good sensual base, we have good, clear communication, we might work in more erotic areas. So in that case, it might be if, you know, talking about a male client who has problems achieving an erection, that's when we start working on that. But even then, the touch is very non-goal-oriented and centrally based. After that, once we've met all the client's goals, really the last stage is closure. It's learning how to celebrate and appreciate the relationship, but not hold on and get ready to move on to the next chapter of their lives. Again, this is modeling a good, healthy relationship for the clients. And part of that sometimes is having a decent breakup.
What does that look like? How do you close out a relationship with a client?
So different people do it different ways. And having not been through the process, I don't know how I would do it. But sometimes there's an exchange of cute cards. Like, oh, my experience with you was really meaningful and I learned this. There might be some other gift giving. But it is a cross between the ending of a business relationship and something that is also deeply personal. Because honestly, at this point in time, they have left their mark on our lives and we have changed their lives. They're now able to go out into the world and have healthy relationships, which they haven't been able to do before.
Is it ever a situation where somebody ends a relationship with a client and then they come back later? Like maybe either to work on another thing or like, well, I thought I had this handled, but no. Turns out.
There are many points during the work that there might be client resistance. A client might have life circumstances change where, hey, they've met someone and they want to try out their sexy selves on this new person. And that relationship might work or it might not. And they might come back 6 months, 2 years later and say, yeah, I thought I had all my stuff together and I really didn't. And then we get to start again.
Yay. I don't know why I'm excited for that. Well, yeah.
Go ahead.
I was actually just going to sort of take us to the place where, like, so if someone is interested in this, like, let's say you are a person who thinks that you would benefit from this. Can you just go to any old therapist and be like, hey, hook me up with a surrogate?
So you don't hook up with a surrogate.
Well, yeah.
You hire a surrogate professional.
Give me one of them surrogates.
You could be in therapy with any old therapist. A sex therapist is definitely helpful if you're talking about issues of sexuality, but it's not necessary. If you are a client and you're talking to a therapist and you say, hey, I really want to work on these issues, I think a surrogate partner is right for me, contact IPSA. Their website is surrogatetherapy.org. They have a referral section right there, and they'll just guide you through the process. So they will tell you what to expect. They will also help you locate a surrogate partner in your area.
And given that you were one of the few on the East Coast, you'll pop up in their search results?
I think we have a searchable map with the certified surrogate partners. Since I'm not officially fully certified, you would have to call up the referrals office and they know that, that I'm here. There are also several folks in the D.C. area. We're kind of a new little pod on the East Coast, so there are several people to work with there.
And if somebody wants to work with you in particular, they've been so moved by this and like, oh, that nice.
I know.
That nice,
the
Brian.
Sound of my voice on the podcast.
Yeah. Is there any way that we can send therapists to work with you?
Well, interesting that you should mention that. So I do have my own website. It is bgsurrogatetherapy.com. They could find me there. They could also contact IPSA directly and say, hey, I heard a podcast with Brian Gibney. I would be interested in working with him. Could you put me in touch? And finally, IPSA is going to have a therapist training for working with surrogates in late February. So if there's a therapist out there who wants to learn how to work with surrogates or more about the surrogate partner therapy process, they could either contact IPSA or they could contact me and we will get them in on that workshop.
All right. Well, Ryan, I want to thank you for coming on today and giving us the update on where surrogacy is in 2018.
My pleasure.
That's very cool. So thank you so much. And thank you, everyone, for listening. And have a great day. Thank you for listening to Sex with Timory. Sex with Timory, the podcast, is produced by Nathan Karuna. Our opening music is by Charles Evans. Our closing music is by Hanya Lee. Be sure to check out sexwithtimory.com, Sex with Timory on Facebook, and tweet at me, Timory_LEIGH. If you're a fan of the show, if you like it at all, a little bit maybe even, rate and review us on iTunes and tell your friends all about it. And thank you.